Chapter 11. Sadanko. Late on a Friday afternoon in August 1996, I learned of another intriguing investment idea. It was a sizzling hot day. The only sounds in our office were the gentle whir of the computers, the hum of our air conditioner, and the intermittent buzzing of a large horsefly. The city outside lay unnaturally still. On summer Fridays, Moscow poured all of her citizens into their countryside cabins, called dachas. That afternoon it felt as if we were the only people left in the city. As my small team was about to leave for the weekend, the phone rang. "Hermitage, zdravstvuyte," Svetlana said, sounding bored. She swiveled in her chair and cupped her hand over the receiver.
"Bill, it's Yuri."
"Yuri, put him through." I got on the phone, and he whispered,
"Hey, Bill, I've got a 4% block of Sadanko. You interested?"
"What's that?"
"It's a big oil company in western Siberia that no one's heard of."
"Who controls it?"
"A group headed by Potanin."
Everyone knew who Vladimir Potanin was, a tough-looking Russian billionaire oligarch with a pockmarked face, who was also a deputy prime minister of Russia. "How much do they want for the 4%?
36.6 million.
Although my fund was growing, it couldn't buy a block that big, no matter how attractive it seemed. However, if the stock was interesting, the fund could buy part of the block. I remained silent as I thought about it.
"If it's not interesting, don't worry," Yuri said.
No, Yuri, it may be. I'd like to do some homework."
"No problem."
"How long do I have?"
"I don't know. I can probably keep it quiet for a week before the seller starts pressing, but it's not as if there are many people out there looking for second-tier stocks."
I hung up with Yuri, and my little team and I left the office for the weekend. But as I went home that day, I had that tingling, greedy tension in my gut, similar to when I saw my $2,000 Polish investment multiply by nearly 10 times, or when I'd unearthed the Russian voucher scheme. I knew Yuri wouldn't shop the deal to someone behind my back, but I also knew that a truly good opportunity wouldn't last very long. I came back to the office early on Saturday morning and started to leaf through analyst reports and articles to see if I could learn anything about Sadanko, but there wasn't anything in our files. As soon as my team arrived on Monday morning, I called Clive over to my desk. "I've been looking for information on Sadanko, but couldn't find any here. Can you call around and see if any of our brokers have anything?" He said he'd get right on it. I left for a series of meetings, and when I returned around noon, I asked Clive if he'd made any discoveries, but he hadn't. There were no research reports, articles, data, or even reliable gossip. There was nothing on Sadanko. This was frustrating, but it made some sense. A company like Lukoil, which had 67% of its shares trading in the market, was a liquid stock and generated lots of commissions for brokers. These commissions paid for research analysts to write reports for investors looking at the shares. Conversely, in the case of Sadanko, which had only 4% of its shares trading in the market, there weren't going to be enough commissions to compel any analyst to waste time writing research reports. "Well, I guess we'll just have to go and get the information ourselves then," I said. Going after information in Russia was like hurtling down the rabbit hole. Ask a question, get a riddle. Track a lead, hit a wall. Nothing was self-evident or clear. After 70 years of KGB-instilled paranoia, Russians were careful to guard their information. Even inquiring after a person's health could feel like asking someone to reveal a state secret, and I knew that asking about the condition of a company would prove exponentially more difficult. I was undaunted, though. As I got started, I remembered that one of my classmates at Stanford ran a monthly trade magazine about oil and gas. Maybe he would have some information on Sadanko. I called him up, but instead of talking about Sadanko, he tried to get me to sign up for a subscription. "It's only $10,000, he said cheerfully. I had no interest in subscribing. That's a little out of my price range. He laughed. Tell you what, Bill, since we were at Stanford together, I'll send you some back issues for free.
Great, thanks.
Next, I turned to the pile of business cards on my desk. If I'd been a London investment banker, my Rolodex would have been bursting with embossed cards on thick stock. In Russia, my collection was humbler. Some were printed on cardboard. Others were orange or green or light blue. Some looked as if they'd been printed on a home computer. Two cards were stuck together because of cheap ink. Still, I went through them. This was simply the way it was in Russia. I peeled a couple of cards apart and discovered someone I'd forgotten. Dmitry Severov, a consultant at a Russian finance company. I'd met Dmitry while still at Solomon Brothers and remembered that he was in the business of advising Russian oil companies on how to get bank loans. I figured he would know something about Sedanko. I picked up the phone, called his office, and asked for a meeting. He didn't seem to be a man in demand and readily agreed. Dmitry's office was in a residential apartment building on a quiet side street north of the Kremlin, which was one of the most desirable neighborhoods in Moscow. A single guard was sitting in a security booth at the entrance, smoking a cigarette, dressed in an all-black uniform. He could have passed for a special forces soldier, were it not for his rubber sandals. Without even looking up, he waved me through to the elevator. I pulled out the address Svetlana had written down and frowned. Dmitry's office was located on the 5th and a half floor. I had no idea what that meant. Did I take the elevator to the 5th floor and walk up, or the 6th and walk down? A man brushed past me and hit the call button. The elevator was slow to arrive and was as narrow as a telephone booth. I had to squeeze in next to the man or risk waiting another 10 minutes. He hit 5 and eyed me suspiciously. I looked at the floor and said nothing. We exited the elevator and went our separate ways. I followed a trail of cigarette butts up a half flight of stairs. There, a round, elderly woman led me into the apartment, and I wondered if she was Dmitry's mother or his secretary. She told me he was having lunch and directed me to the kitchen. "Sit, sit," he said when I entered, pushing aside a basket of gray bread and a glass jar full of sugar. I sat in a vinyl chair opposite him, and tried not to watch as he sopped up his cabbage soup with the bread.
"What can I do for you?" he asked between mouthfuls.
"I'm researching oil companies."
"Good. You came to the right place."
"Can you tell me anything about Sedanko?"
"Of course. I know everything about Sedanko."
He got up and left the kitchen, and in a moment he was back with a large spreadsheet.
"What do you want to know?"
"How about their reserves, for a start?" We looked through the spreadsheet together, and he pointed to a column. According to his data, Sedanko had 6 billion barrels of oil reserves. By multiplying the price of the 4% block by 25, I got the price of the whole company, $550 million. I divided that by the number of barrels of oil in the ground, which told me that Sedanko was trading at 9 cents per barrel of oil reserves in the ground. Which was crazy, because at the time the market price for a barrel of oil was $20. I frowned. Something wasn't right. If these numbers were even close to correct, Sedanko was cheap beyond belief. "Unbelievable," I said under my breath. I thanked Dmitry and left. When I got back to the office, I had Clive figure out the valuation for Lukoil, the most widely followed Russian oil company. After hanging up with a broker, Clive passed me his calculation. I stared at the figures for several seconds. "These can't be right."
"These are the numbers the broker gave me," he said defensively.
What didn't seem right was that Lukoil was trading at a price 10 times higher than that of Sedanko per barrel of oil reserves, yet they appeared to be comparable companies. Why would Lukoil's valuation be so much higher? Clive narrowed his eyes. Maybe there's something wrong with Sadako? Maybe. But what if there isn't? It really could just be cheaper. That would be brilliant. But how can we know for sure? We're going to ask them, and if they won't tell us, we'll ask other people until we figure it out. The following day, we began our investigation. The Sadako offices were located in a business district on the western embankment of the Moscow River, not far from the British ambassador's residence. The offices were in a former Tsar's mansion. Svetlana came with me. A pretty secretary with long blonde hair and pencil-thin heels met us in reception and ushered us into a 70s-era conference room with wood veneer sideboards and a faded velveteen sofa. She told us that a manager would be with us shortly. We were made to wait for half an hour before an executive in the strategic development department entered the room. He carried himself with the air of a board chairman who'd been shuttling between meetings all morning. He was tall and thin, in his early 30s and already balding. He mumbled something in Russian, which I did not understand.
"He is sorry to keep you waiting," Svetlana translated. "He asks, what can he help you with?"
"Пожалуйста," the man said. "Чай?"
"He wants to know if you would like tea,"
Svetlana said, awkwardly sitting on a leather chair between the two of us. The man checked his watch. The clock was ticking. I turned down his offer of tea. "Tell him I would like to know how large their oil reserves are," I said. I already had a number, but I wanted to know if it was right. He squirmed in his seat as if he understood me, but waited for Svetlana to translate. He drew his lips in a tight smile, crossing one leg over his opposite knee, and launched into an explanation. After a few minutes, he paused so Svetlana could speak.
"He says the most important thing about oil reserves is a company's drilling technique. He says Sadako has the finest equipment and best engineers in the country."
Before I could jump in, he held up his hand to shush me. He droned on, telling me about drilling, pipeline bottlenecks, and marketing subsidies, as Svetlana dutifully translated.
"He asks if that is all," she said suddenly.
"Can you ask him about the oil reserves?"
"I already did," she said, confused.
But he didn't answer. "Ask him again." Svetlana turned back to him, her cheeks flushed. He leaned back and waited for her to finish. Then he nodded, as if he'd finally understood my question and was about to reveal everything. He talked for a while longer. When I realized he wouldn't pause for Svetlana to translate, I handed her a scrap of paper and a pen. She quickly started scribbling everything down. After 5 minutes, she glanced at me nervously to see if she should keep going. After 10 minutes, she stopped writing. Finally, he wrapped up his lecture and sat forward. He nodded for Svetlana to translate. She looked at her notes.
"He says the best oil in Russia comes from western Siberia. It is much better than the heavy oil coming from the central provinces of Tartarstan and Bashkortostan. He says..."
"Did he say how large the reserves are?" I asked, cutting her off.
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes."
"Ask him again." Svetlana froze. "Go ahead," I nudged. "It's okay." Slowly, she turned to face him. He was no longer smiling. Annoyed, he pulled a mobile phone from his pocket and began to flip through its menus. She meekly asked him the question a third time. He stood and brusquely said something to Svetlana.
"He says he is very late for another meeting," she translated quietly.
Clearly, he had no intention of answering my question. I didn't understand why he was afraid to tell us his reserve numbers. Perhaps he didn't know himself. But in Russia, the conventional wisdom was that only bad things could come from passing real information to anyone. The best way for Russians to deal with direct questions was to talk pointlessly for hours and essentially filibuster the issue. Most people are too polite to keep pushing in this kind of situation, and they often forget the question they asked in the first place. With a good Russian dissembler, you have to be incredibly focused to have even a chance of finding out what you need.
He says he hopes he has told you everything you need to know.
The man reached out to shake my hand.
Please come again soon, he said in perfect English. We are always happy to meet with Western investors.
Clearly, the people at Sedanko weren't going to reveal any information about the company. So I started meeting with other oil companies to see if they knew anything about their competitor. At Lukoil, I was patted down, my possessions x-rayed, my mobile phone and passport held aside until I left. Then I was handed over to a former KGB officer who'd been hired by the Investor Relations Department to deal with foreigners. He took me through an hour-long PowerPoint presentation, showing oil rigs complete with beaming company managers posing in hard hats. At the oil company Yugansk-Neftegaz, the CFO tried to get me to lend the company $1.5 billion to pay for its new refinery. At the Moscow office of Tatneft, a smaller but still large oil company headquartered in Tartarstan, I was invited to help build a highway by investing in the infrastructure of the Tartar Republic. Each meeting went the same way. I started out hopeful and optimistic. Then I was bombarded with irrelevant information, and I left without anything useful. By then, my hunch about Sedanko had developed into something that was taking up way too much time and energy. What did I hope to find out when every analyst at every investment bank had written off Sedanko? Maybe there was a good reason why no one was interested in the 4% block. When I returned to the office after my last meeting, ready to give up, Svetlana handed me a brown envelope.
This just arrived from the U.S., she said excitedly. From that trade magazine guy you spoke to.
You can toss it, I said, without looking at the envelope. I figured it was probably more marketing material promoting the benefits of investing in oil rigs. But then I thought better of it. Maybe there was something in there.
Hang on, I called. Bring it back.
As I leafed through the magazine, I realized that my friend had sent me a treasure trove, the golden ticket to this whole puzzle. This obscure, glossy oil magazine had an appendix with all the relevant data on Russian oil companies, including the elusive Sedanko. Everything I could have wanted to know was there. Oil reserves, production, refining, everything. I didn't have to visit all these companies. It was all here, in one place, looking authoritative and accurate. I pulled out a piece of paper and drew two columns. I titled the first Sedanko and the second Lukoil, and wrote down every company fact I could find in the magazine. When I was done, I looked over the accumulated information. There was practically no difference between the two companies. Little infrastructure had been developed since the fall of the Soviets, and they both had the same rusting oil derricks, and used the same leaky pipelines, and they both had the same unproductive workers who were paid the same measly salaries. The only obvious difference between them was that Lukoil was well known and had lots of brokerage reports written about it. When we compiled the information from these reports and compared them to the information on Lukoil from the magazine, they matched up perfectly. This led me to believe that the information on Sedanko was reliable too. This was a remarkable discovery. Everyone knew that Lukoil was a steal, since it controlled the same amount of oil and gas as British Petroleum, but was 10 times cheaper. Now, here was Sedanko, sitting on a bit less oil than Lukoil, but not much. Only it was 10 times cheaper than Lukoil. In other words, Sedanko was 100 times cheaper than BP. This was a no-brainer if I had ever seen one. My fund bought 1.2% of the company, starting at $4 per share, spending roughly $11 million. It was the largest single investment decision I had ever been involved with in my life. When Edmund Safra heard about what was happening, he wanted to get involved as well, and he promptly bought the same amount for himself. Typically, when a company's shares are publicly traded, The market sets the price for them. But in the case of Cidanco, where 96% was held by one investment group and 4% by minority shareholders, including us, hardly any stock was trading. Therefore, we had no idea if we had done a good deal or not. For a while, I was comfortable with this, but as the months started to pass, I became more and more worried. Good legwork and a bit of self-confidence is one thing, but if I'd screwed up, I would lose a large portion of the fund. As time passed, I began to wonder if maybe I should have stuck with the crowd and not gotten involved in something so adventurous. I fought this trepidation and forced myself to stay hopeful that something good would eventually happen. Finally, a little more than a year later, something did. On October 14, 1997, BP announced it was buying 10% out of Vladimir Potanin's 96% block of Cidanco for a 600% premium to the price we had paid a year earlier. It was a home run.